I'm Amy Hall here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast.
Morning, Amy.
Good morning, Greg.
Is it morning?
It's still morning.
Oh, hey, I'm really jazzed about the way Tactics is doing their second edition. Now, at the moment, it's they got about 35 or 36 reviews, all 5 stars. Most of those are friendlies. Of course, they've read the early edition, so I expected that kind of response out of the gate. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe by now people are listening, then there'll be a little bit more of a mixture. But the other one went for 10 years with about 4.8 average. So I'm really happy about that. And at the moment, it's still the number two book in Christianity. It's weird because it's number four in apologetics, but number two in Christianity. I don't know how they do that at Amazon. And the number one book in Christianity is The Universe Has Your Back. I don't know how that got in the Christianity context.
Who's
but
that
it's very
by?
New. Some bestseller gal. I didn't recognize her name, but she's New York Times bestselling and other titles. But it's completely and utterly new age. It's completely, anyway. So,
hear
but
that,
I'm
everyone?
Two,
buy Tactics to beat out the New Age book.
Anyway, so just I'm a little excited about that.
That's great.
It continues to be, so thank you.
Well, hopefully it'll keep doing well because I think it's really valuable, and I think people will be helped by it.
I agree. That's why I wrote it.
So let's start with a question from Jared Bolus.
All right.
Can you explain the difference between moral objectivism and moral absolutism? Does the latter allow for situational ethics?
Well, the reason I'm pausing is because there's a whole bunch all mixed into there, like there isn't a lot of questions. And so let me see if I can pace myself through this to kind of define some terms, okay? Moral objectivism is the idea that moral qualities, moral properties are had by the things themselves. So, simply put, rape is wrong in itself. If nobody believed rape was wrong, it would still be wrong. Okay. It is not mind dependent. That's subjectivism. It is mind independent. It is wrong in itself. It is a quality of the object. In this case, the object is a behavior, an action. That is not influenced by what anybody thinks about it. Now, that is the chief difference between between moral objectivism and moral relativism, because in relativism, what is true or false morally is up to the individual, and so you could have a whole range of true moral views that are contradicting each other as long as they're being held by different subjects, okay, different individuals. All right. Now, absolutism, and here I'm making a refined distinction. Many people use the word absolute as a synonym for objective when applied to morality. So this is an absolute morality. And what it's often defined as, it means it's true for all people at all times and all circumstances. So lying is absolutely wrong, means that it's always wrong for all people in all circumstances at all times. But it turns out that that's not the case with lying. Biblically, we can demonstrate that there are times when lying is the proper moral choice depending on other factors, okay? So what this kind of absolutism results in then is an inability to distinguish between two courses of action when both courses represent moral concepts in conflict. Do we tell the truth or do we protect innocent human life? And there are occasions in a fallen world where that's the only choices that you have. Rahab the harlot faced that choice. The midwives, the Egyptian midwives faced that choice scripturally now. Corrie Ten Boom faced that kind of choice, and including breaking the law, never mind just lying, but all the things there, the deception and lawbreaking that was involved with hiding Jews and getting special papers for them and all of them that were forged, etc., all to save their lives. So a kind of like a one-dimensional absolutism doesn't allow you to make those distinctions or make decisions when it comes to moral dilemmas, where you have two choices and each of them on their own would be wrong, or two choices and each of them on their own would be right. How do you choose between the two? Okay, characteristically, in kind of a graded absolutism, we acknowledge that some moral principles have more weight than others, and this is a biblical concept. And therefore, that we do the greatest good when we are in a kind of a moral conflict situation like that. But a strict moral absolutism, characterized by the definition I just offered, is not going to allow you to do that. So I don't use the word absolute because it's misleading. And I don't even think the definition of an absolute, even an absolute truth, true for all people at all times and all circumstances, is sound either. So my encouragement is that people just avoid that word altogether. We champion objective truth and including objective morality. All right, but we try to be nuanced in our moral decision making because we understand that there are some things that are greater goods than others, and some things that are greater harms than others. This follows common sense, and it's also biblically sound. Jesus, talking to Pilate, said, "The one who handed me over to you has the greater sin." Okay, pretty straightforward. Now, when it comes to the phrase situational ethics, that actually is a term of art referring to an ethical system by Joseph Fletcher. And situational ethics specifically is the idea that love is the greatest absolute. So in a certain sense, it's not a relativistic system. It's an absolutist system. And love trumps all other considerations. So you do the most loving thing. Now, it sounds, you know, not so bad at first blush, but the problem is the notion of what is loving and what is needs to be informed by other moral concerns. Mm-hmm. And if love is the moral concern that's the greatest good, the summum bonum, and the concept of love is ambiguous, it becomes subjectivistic in practice, whatever feels like the most loving thing to do in any situation is the thing I'm morally obliged to do, even though it seems like it violates some other moral obligation. Okay, so in Joseph Fletcher's system, we have a pseudo-absolutist system. It is structured as an absolute. Love is the absolute, trumps all else. But love then is relativistic in its definition, and so it has a relativizing influence on moral decision making. Situational ethics is not a phrase that applies to making the right moral decision given the situation, because that's always going to be the case. The circumstances are always a factor in making moral decisions, and that's not relativism necessarily. Actually, if the circumstances are what make the determination, it is a form of objectivism, because you're asking what is the right thing to do in that particular set of circumstances. Relativism isn't relative to the circumstances. Relativism is relative to the subject, the individual. Okay, so in any specific set of circumstances, Amy, if you and I were in the exact same circumstances, that the moral decision regarding those circumstances would be the exact same for you and I, because the objective circumstances are the same. Now, what if those circumstances change? Oh, well, then if they do, then we may have to make a new assessment, but the conclusion would still be the same for both of us if we were in exactly the same circumstances relative to that situation. Okay, that's objectivism.
Mm-hmm.
Relativism is this: a fixed set of circumstances. You and I are in the same relationship to that set of circumstances, but you have your truth regarding what's right, and I have my truth regarding what's right, and that's all you can say about it. Well, that's relativism. That's subjectivism. I realize these distinctions are sometimes a little bit esoteric, you know, they're a little bit, well, that's like my brain hurts kind of thing. But these are the kinds of distinctions that it's important to make with these competing systems in order to be clear on what is a sound and appropriate way to make moral decisions. Many times people confuse relativism with objectivism if what you do is you're trying to decide the right course of action based on the circumstances. That is not situational ethics. Situational ethics is capital S, capital E. It's a proper noun. It is an ethical system of Joseph Fletcher. The circumstances always dictate what the right course of action is as long as you have a moral standard that speaks to those circumstances. And that's objectivism.
You said that so well, Greg, that you're not leaving anything for me to say.
Say amen, brother. Let's close in prayer.
The way I usually try to explain people what objective morality is, as I'll say it's like a math problem. You have to have all the factors in place in order to find the right answer.
Right.
But there is one right answer that you're trying to find.
No matter who is trying to solve the problem. That's a great way of putting it. So you did add something.
Yeah.
And then people are saying right now, that makes a lot more sense than what Coco said. And I didn't have to listen as long.
I also wanted to say something more about the situational ethics.
Here comes more brilliant.
Well, I was thinking as you were explaining what that was about, Jesus said that the law, that love is the end of the law. The law is supposed to enable you to love, mm-hmm. which means that you need to know the law if you're going to know what it means to love.
Mm-hmm.
So just as you were saying, you can't just decide whatever your idea of love is.
Mm-hmm.
As Jesus said, that's how we know what love is. Mm-hmm. So we need to know the objective lot in order to know what love means.
Yeah, it's tied to something specific. And this is why in 1 Corinthians 13, we have this characterization. And one of the things in this famous characterization of love that people recite all the time at weddings is that love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. So this is where your concept of law, broadly construed, comes in. What's right and what's wrong? We have to know what's right and what's wrong before we can know whether rejoicing in the thing is an example of love or not.
What is, maybe it was Paul who said, was it Jesus who said it? Who said, for this reason, maybe it was Paul. I might be confusing Paul, where he talks about how whoever fulfills the law is loving. Now I can't think of the verse. I'll probably figure it out when I ask the next question. I'll have to jump back in at the end.
Well, Paul talks in Galatians 5 about walking in the Spirit, and against such things there is no law, because when you're filled with the Spirit, you are doing the things naturally that the law requires.
That's not what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'll think of it while you're answering the next question. We'll see.
Amy was paging through her Bible in microdot there. I don't know how she can read that thing. It's so small.
Okay, here's a question from Blue Checkist.
Who knows what microdot means anymore? Okay. Next.
All right. Sexual libertines fall back on appeals to consent to reconcile their support for homosexuality with their current opposition to pedophilia, incest, and bestiality, saying what two consenting adults do is nobody's business. How would you take the roof off of this assertion?
Well, there are all kinds of things that seem, when you just think about it, if the idea... lots going through my mind right now. So to go back to the statement, so sexual libertinism is justified by an appeal to consent, which does not apply in the case of pedophilia or bestiality. Really? I'm not sure that that's actually true. Part of the justification for pedophilia is that both parties seem to be consenting. Okay, and those who are advancing pedophilia advance it in that sense. Now, somebody might say, well, children can't give consent. Well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. That may be a debatable point. Whether it's good for children, that's a different issue, even if the children give consent. Okay, and so it's not entirely clear. And bestiality, I don't know why that's a factor, that consent is a factor. Animals don't seem to care about these kinds of things, and so even if they did care about it, we still make them beasts of burden, you know, so that's not... So it isn't as if that one way of looking at it will rule out the bizarre things and will justify the not-so-bizarre things. that would be one way. That would be more of a just the facts, ma'am, I guess. And I don't know that it is the case. I guess my question then is going to be, why is the idea of consenting adults the only factor involved? Let's just say, here's more of a classical taking the roof off. Frank Beckwith would be really good at this one, by the way. He can think of more bizarre circumstances than I can. But that's the way his mind works on these matters. He gets right to the heart of it. Well, let's just say that two people consented to mutilating each other. Okay, so well, they're two adults, and what they're going to do is carve each other's bodies up, or they're gonna each cut off a piece of flesh and eat it. Okay, and Amy's screwing up her face here because it's kind of gross. Okay, I agree, but I don't think it's just gross. I think it's clearly morally questionable, and so the question really we're asking ourselves is that is consent the thing that captures the fullness of the moral project when it comes to sexuality? That the only thing that matters is consent, okay? Why would somebody say that? Where do you get a justification that consent is the only thing? Because we can think of examples that seem to be morally bizarre where consent is in place. So sadomasochism, for example, is a case in point, where a person is sadistic and someone who is masochistic, and there's a match there when we got consent. Really? Okay, so that's okay. Well, it would be according to this view, but doesn't it seem, just as we reflect on it, that that's not adequate? I don't know what else is behind all of this, a view of what it means to be human. We can give consent, and the biggest good, the greatest good is individual liberty, and so doing what we want. Gee, where did you get that idea that we have the right to do what we want? Where did that come from? You know, if you are an atheist, I don't know how you could conclude that we have any rights like that. We're just animals. And we just have an animal nature. We have no moral, what's the word I'm looking for? I say moral rights, but I mean moral. A right is when someone has an obligation towards you regarding something, you know, to give you something or to leave you alone with regard to something. And this is an appeal to leave them alone regarding something. But where does such a moral obligation come from in a world without God? That's another thing, okay? Well, evolution. Well, so far, evolution hasn't secured for us the right for everybody to do whatever they want with their own body. Most people think that that's a problem, so evolution is not going to help you there. If you appeal to it, you lose because the vote's against you in terms of evolution, if that's the kind of argument you're going to make. So I don't know. There's a couple of thoughts here. I think the bigger thing is that someone has to defend the notion that liberty trumps all other considerations. My personal liberty, as long as somebody else agrees, that's all that's necessary for us to justify our behaviors sexually. If our bodies are made for certain ends, and those ends and sexuality falls in that category, then it seems that certain moral obligations apply to us to fulfill the body to those ends. And if our bodies aren't made for certain ends, then all kinds of bizarre things seem to follow. Why can't we eat our own fingers? I mean, if we just, you know, if it doesn't hurt us to do that, what does it mean for anything to be broken or unhealthy when it comes to physical bodies if our bodies are not made for certain ends? Isn't the whole notion of unhealth, lack of health, that our bodies are not accomplishing the ends for which they were made, which we call health? That notion, by the way, is now falling by the wayside, especially with regards to mental health, because people have denied that there is any teleology. And so in a certain sense, there's consistency there. But they also want to hold on to the idea that we have rights to do what we want, inconsistent with our bodily teleology, which they deny. But rights are a type of teleology as well. Humans are made for certain ends because they're certain type of creatures. Creatures that have towards whom we have moral responsibilities, i.e. rights. So, you know, what's it going to be?
Yeah, and I think you can find out where they're being inconsistent as you press them on their reasons for why they accept some things and reject some things. So incest, well, what if they're both the age of consent and they agree? Well, now you have to, but you still think incest is wrong. Well, why? So maybe you could press them on some inconsistencies there too.
Yeah, and yeah, that's another counterexample. Excuse me, I'm not convinced that the problem with incest is genetic. I mean, there are problems there, but Dennis Prager made the observation that the, and I think it's really insightful, the Jewish intellectual and radio talk show host. The observation that God prohibited incest in the Bible so that children and family members would not be sexualized, that home, the home and the family is a place where there's safety from sexual predators. And considering the strength of the sexual nature, especially the male sexual nature, this kind of requirement was necessary. And I think it still applies. We need protection for our children from sexual predation, whether it's direct or whether it's indirect, like inappropriate exposure to sexual things in films and TV or at school where they're introduced to all kinds of adult things when they're not old enough to manage that well. That's a type of predation too, in my view.
So in closing, to go back to the previous question, I did find the passage I was thinking of, and I was wrong. It was not Jesus. It was Paul. So what I was thinking of was Romans 13, 8 through 10. Owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law.
That reminds me, too, by the way, adultery can be done between consenting adults and still break a vow that one has towards someone else and still injure the family, et cetera, et cetera. So that might be a good counterexample for the question we were just dealing with. Good verse.
Well, thank you, Greg. We mixed those two questions up a little bit. Hopefully everyone can straighten that out. So thank you again, everyone, for your questions. Please keep sending those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.